A monument to history.
We're all one blood. We're all one people, essentially. And it doesn't matter what we look like. And it's built in the shape of a lighthouse because it's supposed to be a beacon of peace and prosperity and hope to preserve the history.
The history of Standing Stone, today in the Upper Cumberland.
Rebecca Beeler, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How did your interest in the history of Standing Stone come about?
Well, it's kind of a family tradition. My grandfather was heavily involved. I've been involved ever since I got here.
When he was involved, did it fascinate you then, or it was kind of like, okay, yeah, great?
Oh, no, it was fantastic. It was our heritage. It's our bloodline. So,
why did it interest you, do you think?
Just knowing where I came from. Those are my roots, my mountains, my town.
Hmm. What is it about it that you find fascinating?
It's the connectivity of everything and being part of nature and letting that cultivate an appreciation and a use of the resources.
That's at its heart?
Absolutely.
Hmm. The Standing Stone history is interesting. Where does the dating go back? I mean, where do we think that the date originates? Is it a for sure date, or is it what we think?
It's what we think. So what we think is it's Paleolithic at best. And it was a 16-foot dog-shaped monolith that was on the old Walton Road. It was the trade road. And it set on the precipice on the western edge of town. And the town wasn't even there. It was called Standing Stone because it was named for the stone itself. That was the ultimate landmark on that road. And so when there was trade routes between the nations, there was Creek tribe. They were a little bit more nomadic travelers, and they had their own trade routes or whatever, but they came in contact with the Cherokee, and they would gather, and everybody knew whose land was what and who hunted where and that sort of thing, and they would gather there and trade and do ceremonies at the stone. And what happened was, in 1893, Monterey was being born. It was incorporated in 1893, and when the railroad came through to make the most of the natural resources, the coal, the timber, all of that, the railway had to be there or there was going to be no commerce. So they blew through the stone for the railroad right-of-way, and when they did that, they obliterated the entire monolith. So there was two huge boulders left. People would take souvenirs off the train. They would take and chip away at it, and so there was only two huge boulders. One was put over at the old post office, used as a hitching post when they would tie up their horses, and then that's what they used to get back up on their horses. And the other one, the Improved Order in Redmen, Narragansett Tribe 25, took and built that lighthouse-shaped monument right in the middle of town and stuck it on top to preserve it.
So how big do we think the original Standing Stone was?
The estimate is 10 to 16 feet tall. So as tall as the monument is now.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're talking about the path, the road, the trading path, mm-hmm. I guess as you referred to it, this was, again, you have to put yourself back in that point. There's no interstates. There's no highways. This is the main roadway, quote unquote.
Exactly.
That people used, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because that's the monolith was there, and that was the landmark to know which community you were in, and it was named Standing Stone Community before Monterey was incorporated in 1893. But the significance of that monolith, the only thing that's left is what's on the top of that pedestal. Now, that was built in 1895, and it was dedicated October 17th, 1895. And there was a big crowd. There was like 3,000 people in this tiny little just-born town. And they celebrated it, and they dedicated it, and they came together. But the lighthouse shape pedestal that the stone is sitting on top of, it actually has a lot of symbolism put into it. Each rock around the lighthouse is different, and that was supposed to be indicative of everybody looks different, but we're all still people. And then the mortar between the rocks on the pedestal was, it was red. It was like a brick-colored mortar. And that was for the bloodlines that went through in between the rocks, so that we're all one blood, we're all one people, essentially. And it doesn't matter what we look like. And it's built in the shape of a lighthouse because it's supposed to be a beacon of peace and prosperity and hope to preserve the history.
Why was it originally created back in, what did you say, Paleolithic? Paleolithic.
Yes. There's a lot of theories on that. My personal theory is that it was ceremonial. And what the Cherokee used to do, like in times of war, they would have a pole in the middle of the village, and they would set the pole in the village, and they would take their hatchet and put it in the pole, and everybody would know that that was, we're at war, we're in wartime. But when it was over, they would take the pole out of the ground, hatchet and all, and bury it outside of the village, and it was called burying the hatchet, which meant peacetime. And that's where we get that phrase from. So in my personal opinion, where that road comes together is where people were allowed to meet, and that was always a peaceable place. There was never any fighting there that I have ever been able to find in my research.
But it just boggles the imagination that, I mean, that would be a difficult thing to build with today's tools.
Absolutely.
So can you imagine turning the clock back to that time period?
And I wonder if it was chiseled out, or if it kind of had that shape anyway and they finished it. I have to wonder that. But they were very, very, very smart and very ingenuitive, and they knew what they were doing, and it was a special thing to them, so they took care of it.
For those that aren't familiar with it, that maybe have never seen it, and I'm sure there's people listening right now that have never seen it, the shape of it, both originally and what we have left today, meaning in that?
Well, if you know, there's a lot of creation stories with the Native American tribes, and maybe this is not necessarily a creation story, but it's a flood story, and it kind of is very similar to Noah and the Ark. Do you want me to say that?
Yeah, say that again. Sorry.
No, you're
I was fine. Trying to hold it.
Oh, bless. The Cherokee have a flood story that parallels Noah and the Ark. Except during that flood, the animal that was most trusted was the dog in the Cherokee Nation. It wasn't a dove that found the land. It was a dog that found the land. He swam to the nearest mountaintop and barked his best friend back over to show him where the land was. And so dogs are a sacred animal to the Cherokee.
That's so fascinating. Rebecca Beeler is our guest as we talk about the history of Standing Stone. Rebecca Beeler is our guest. Were there Native Americans still living in the area of Monterey when the original Standing Stone was destroyed?
Yes. Yes, they were. Now, as we all may or may not know, the Indian Removal Act of 1830 occurred when President Jackson was in office. By 1838, they had been forcibly removed. Some hid in our mountains, in Monterey Mountain. Some married Europeans to be able to stay off the rosters. So they were still there. And my great-grandmother remembered a Native Cherokee family. And she remembered being really small, but she was afraid of them, but they were friends with the parents. So she might have been... I guess it was my great-great-grandparents who had hosted them, and she remembers them being very tall and have booming voices and very sure and talking to her parents, but she remembers being afraid of them because she didn't know them very well, and she was just tiny. So
it's interesting because when we think of the Trail of Tears, for example, we don't necessarily think of the Cherokee that were here. But exactly. They were impacted as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the reason why we have an Eastern and Western band is because they made the reservation not just in Oklahoma. They had a reservation in North Carolina as well. So those who chose to went to North Carolina, even though it was still forced, but they went ahead. And then the rest were taken to Oklahoma, forced to Oklahoma. And they say that, and my grandmother told me this as well, she went to Oklahoma with my grandfather, who was heavily involved with Standing Stone Day, and was a member of the Standing Stone Historical Society. And they had gone to see a medicine man out there, one of their good friends, Croslin Smith was his name. And on their way to Oklahoma, it was said that for every Cherokee tear that fell, there was a rose shape and colored rock that would emerge from the ground. You can still find those rocks there. They are indigenous to that area, but they brought some back for us.
It's amazing. I asked the question about were there families there, because one has to wonder, did those people of Cherokee heritage, did they react when the original stone was broken? Did they, you know, was this seen as, you know, this is just, again, the white man destroying the heritage?
That's how I feel about it, for sure. And that's why it's so important to me to preserve that history and keep telling the story, because the only way history will be lost is if you stop telling the story. But that is actually what happened between the time that the stone monument was dedicated in 1895. 84 years passed, everyone forgot what it meant or what it was for. They didn't have the history right there.
No, so the historical society did not exist?
Not then, no.
Really?
Yeah. So that was the only Standing Stone Day, the first one. And sometimes some of the Cherokee band members would come back and have a pilgrimage back to the stone because they remembered the story. But as the town shifted and people were moving in and more commerce and things like that, the populace changed. And so they weren't there when it happened. They weren't there when it was dedicated. They don't remember the story. So it wasn't passed down, except my great-grandmother did. And her kids knew the story. And so one of her kids, Dr. Oplis Walker, and her other kid, my granddad, Collie Bahannon, they got together, and they were members of the Improved Order of Red Men. It was a fraternity to protect the historical prevalence of the stone monument. They are the ones who brought back Standing Stone Day in 1979. And they said, this is what happened 84 years ago, but we don't need to forget the story now. So that's why we started celebrating Standing Stone Day ever since 1979.
What were they met with in terms of, did people want to know that history? Did people appreciate it?
I think so. Because the Historical Society emerged. They had the Standing Stone Press, and they would put out Monterey stories and historic things that made it special. And I don't know any other community or any other township that has their own actual holiday on the books. Standing Stone Day is a Monterey holiday. And up until this year, the city workers got that holiday off.
How did the Historical Society kind of evolve from those beginnings in the late 70s?
So the Historical Society was made up of the members who were trying to reestablish Standing Stone Day. And it became the vocal point that shared the story, held all the festivities, paid for it. We used to have sportsmen's dinners, wild game dinners, things like that. Just a lot of dancers. There's parade and all of that. It's kind of evolved because as those members got older, they weren't replaced, which is where I come in. In 2004, my grandpa, Collie Bahannon, passed away, and they weren't going to have a Standing Stone Day that year, and the society was going to dissipate. And I said no, essentially. And I just kind of put myself in that position, and I wasn't like an officer or anything, but just volunteered and like, no, let's do this. We can do this. And so I've been involved since 2004 as a member of their board.
I guess things evolve and things change and maybe some of the history fades away, you know, as you add a bounce house or a food truck or something like that, does the history become less revered? Is that one of the things you deal with in an event like this?
Unfortunately, and until 2 years ago, the society was responsible for all the festivities. So we organized it and planned and everything. And the city has taken over the festivities part of it. So we're focusing more on the education, the history, and the preservation. So what we do now is I go into the schools with the treasurer, Joy Callahan, who is my first cousin once removed. I'm telling you, it's a big family thing. And we go into the schools and we tell the kids the story and why it's significant. And we also hold and sponsor a essay and art contest where the kids can submit entries and they're judged on the significance and the clarity and what they understood of the story that we tell, and to keep it alive. And they can win a cash prize. And I also own a newspaper that I run in Monterey once a month. So they get published. We publish their essay and art entries. We had a whole bunch this year. It was super fantastic. They did such a good job. But it was so cute because at the Burks Elementary presentation, there was a little boy who remembered the presentation from last year. And he asked his teacher if he could speak to me. And I said, sure, what's going on? Do you have a question? He said, didn't you forget a part? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, there were two stones left over, and one was used as the hitching post. And they're remembering, and they're taking it forward, and they really love learning the language. I try to teach them Cherokee phrases and why the Cherokee are called Cherokee, which is actually not their name. It's not their tribe name. Ani Yunwea is the principal people. That's what their tribe name is called. But I try to explain and make it full fold where, you know, when the Europeans came into contact with a tribe and their trade routes and whatnot, whatever the word they heard first was usually adopted. Well, Jalaki is how we say Cherokee. That was a Creek word for those other people. Like, that's not us, that was them, that was those other, the wow. other tribe. So that was adopted by the Europeans, and later on they just kind of took it on as a mantle because that's how everyone knew them. So I explained that to the kids too, so that they see full circle how cultures can collide, but then we still come out full circle, and we still have the day, and we can still preserve what was there.
Was it a situation for the society, and I'm not putting you on the spot to speak for the society, but was it that it was more important, really, to get into the schools and talk about the history than the day itself?
To forward it, because that's how I start every presentation. An untold story is a forgotten story. And if we don't tell them, they won't know. And we'll lose the history again for another 84 years or however long it takes someone else to revive it. So this time, we're trying not to lose the history. And putting it in the hands of the kids is the best way to ensure that.
How important is it to help them understand that, whoops, that's all right. How important is it for them to understand Native American history beyond what's in movies, what's in television shows, of people that actually lived and walked on the land that you live and walked on?
Exactly. The movies and TV, that's fantasy, and that is for entertainment, and that's fine, but it doesn't ensure accuracy. And I would rather them know them as a people and not a character. It's more personable that way. They can imagine themselves in that position, in a compromised position like during the removal, or in a compromised position when the stone was blown up, and how resilient, and that the history will always be there, even if it's not told. It will reemerge eventually. because it does repeat itself. But the whole point is we don't want it to. We don't want it to repeat itself. We don't want people to be singled out that way. We don't want to hurt. We want peace and unity. And the only way to do that is to remind them of how it wasn't supposed to be like that, but it did happen.
I guess the other part that interests me is the fact that we're not talking that this was one person or three families or whatever. We're talking this community was made up of entire Cherokee, right? I mean, at the ultimate point.
Right. Well, at the core.
At the core.
Absolutely.
It was a Cherokee community.
Now we have more moving in because it's a beautiful area. Lots of wonderful things there. But I tell the kids in the presentation, I remind them, this is your story now. This is your town. Even if you weren't here, even if your great-great-grandpa didn't live here, that's not the point. This is your town now, and you're protecting it now. You tell the story. It belongs to them.
But the story can't be told without the Cherokee. Not
oh,
the full
absolutely
story.
Not. No, no. So they need to know how they were treated, what the history of that is, and I keep saying full circle because that the lighthouse part of the monument is a circle at its base. And if you don't say it out loud to keep it from happening again, that circle would be broken. It has to come full circle. I don't want the kids thinking it's okay for someone to be ostracized or for a whole people to be ostracized. It's never okay for that. So it's really important that they know the history. The significance of the stone itself is monumental, but...
No pun intended.
Exactly. but it's the underlying social issues that go into it. They need to understand that they're the ones who can stop that from happening again.
And it happened in their backyard.
Yes.
Not at some faraway place.
Right. It brings it home for them. It's like, oh, that happened here. But so, I mean, I'd explain to them, like, well, if you listen to someone from England, speaking English, like...
The Queen's English.
The Queen's English. It's different than what we sound like, but technically it's still English. But that's what happened to the Cherokee's language. The Western Band speaks a little differently than the Eastern Band. And the words they use are not exactly interchangeable. But when you put it all like that... And they grab on to those little bits of history. It makes sense to them. And they're like, oh, it makes so much sense. That's what happened. And they understand. They understand. They obviously absorb a lot. And they really love hearing the difference. Because that's not in the school books. So that's where the presentation comes in.
Rebecca Beeler is our guest as we talk about the work of the Standing Stone Historical Society. With Rebecca Beeler, we're talking Standing Stone. How rewarding is it? Because I know it had to be a tough decision to decide, okay, the city's going to do the festivities and we're going to work on this part. But how rewarding is it to see the number of essays and the kids get into it?
It is extremely rewarding because that is the whole point. People may come festival day if the weather is good, and there's so many factors that can go into that, and we're so happy when that happens, and if you know they get the weather they deserve and get to have the wonderful, beautiful day. But the two most important things to me were the essay and art contest for the kids and the ceremony at the stone. Those are two things that are very near and dear to my heart that I will protect always. It needs to be as close to ceremonially accurate, and the kids need to know the story. And so we can't just say, oh, we're having an essay and art contest, and good luck. You have to tell them the story. What are they drawing about? What are they writing about? And it helps us understand also how much they're absorbing in their entries. So we had so many teachers encourage their kids, put it into their curriculum. And that's another thing we want to work on is building a unit study. That's another thing I'm working on is building the unit study to put into the schools for our kids to learn our history because, like I said, it belongs to them.
What is the ceremony that goes on for those that don't know?
So I mentioned earlier burying the hatchet. We lay a corn wreath at the base of the stone and a tomahawk at the base of the stone. And it's not a whole lot of fluff or anything like that. It's very, very straightforward. You tell the history of the stone, and then they parade the wreath and the tomahawk. The tomahawk is laid to symbolize burying the hatchet, and then we say how they used to have the peace and war times symbolism. But the corn wreath, it's very interesting because, like I said, full circle. The circles are very important, but the corn is just as important. Corn in Cherokee is selu, and selu was the corn mother earth goddess figurehead for the tribe. And when she died, she gave of her body corn seed to grow so that she could make sure her children were well fed. A good corn crop meant another year of sustenance, another year of prosperity. It was very important to them. And so I had to tell that to the kids and then say, so when the pilgrims came over and they didn't have any food to grow and the natives showed them how to cultivate and farm and the agriculture of it, they were also fed. So it was very, it's very symbolic of forwarding that prosperity and it not just keeping it for yourself. You don't keep it just for your tribe. You share because you're ensuring their survival as well.
I think that's so fascinating. A totally different topic, but it's so amazing from the standpoint that I wonder how hard it is for children of today to even imagine, you know, really where food comes from. I mean, because so few of their parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles farm anymore. We're so far away from that as a society to imagine that this group of people came to this country and they didn't know how to do that. I mean, it's just like, wow, amazing. It's great that you're keeping that alive. So what is the health of what's left of the Standing Stone?
The health of the monument itself? It's been shored up and remortared, and it's looking good. There's a nice little path to it. There's benches around it. You can visit. It's right beside the library in Monterey. So grab your book and go sit on the bench and take in the view of the stone and the history that it literally shines to.
But I would imagine that the society spends a lot of time and effort just to make sure that it will live on for 40, 50, 80, 100 more years.
Well, we will be there and absolutely will be supportive of any efforts to make sure that it's sound and isn't dilapidated or anything like that. But actually, the county, Putnam County, contributed to shoring it up and kind of revitalizing it. So we appreciate them super.
Finally, Rebecca, what does this culture mean to you?
Home. They're my people. So they're my children's people, and my kids learn the history just like everybody else, and they are a part of it because they're forwarding it too. And everybody that hears the story, it makes the monument mean that much more. And when you do that, it makes the town even more special. It puts it on the map. It's still a landmark. And so, full circle, the monolith that was a landmark is still a landmark in Monterey.
Rebecca Beeler with the Standing Stone Historical Society. Thanks for educating us today.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome.